Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
But you also had people that were very fine people.
Very fine people.
On both sides.
And the aliens with mind meld and give them the technology. They're bad aliens.
So
are you surprised the Nazis were influenced by demons?
No, if demons are real, I would definitely think they'd be on the side of the Nazis.
Yeah.
McDonald's is connected to the Clintons. They chop up the bodies and put them into the sausage and hamburgers. People are being cannibalized. Look it up.
And I'm watching CNN talk about this as violent white nationalist protests. We have done everything in our power to keep this peaceful, you know?
It's Pepe's become kind of a symbol.
Welcome to Yeah Nah Passeran, a show about fascism and its gravediggers. I'm Cam Smith.
I'm Andy Fleming.
And this week we are joined by Dr. Jason Wilson, investigative journalist extraordinaire. Jason, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, as always, for having me on.
Now, Dr. Wilson, you have been diving into the private emails of New York social butterfly Jeffrey Epstein. What have you found?
It's less a question of what I found. I have written one story since the DOJ's big release came out, which was about Epstein's, after he was first convicted, imprisoned, and released, you know, in 2009, 2010, he served a 13-month sentence. And almost immediately, he was back socializing with a network that includes what are now some of the richest people in the world. There was a particular kind of network called the Edge Network, which was put together by this literary agent and, I guess, tech propagandist by the name of John Brockman. And he would host dinners, these annual dinners, one of which he just baldly called Billionaire's Dinner. And guests at those dinners included Epstein alongside the likes of Jeff Bezos, Larry Page and Sergey Brin, the founders of Google, and others. People can check out other details in the story. I guess what the emails revealed was that we knew that Epstein had not only funded the Edge Network, but attended these dinners prior to his trial, conviction, and imprisonment on the state law or the state charges. He was convicted under soliciting an underage prostitute, something like that, which is a pretty troublesome way to frame things, that an underage person can be a prostitute. But anyway, and there were apparently worries that the feds had at that time when they cut him a deal that maybe some of his victims could be liable for prosecution under those charges. That's what Acosta, the Trump first administration Labor secretary and then the U.S. attorney, assistant U.S. attorney in Florida, claimed to have been one of the reasons that they cut a deal, which was that they didn't want to expose any of his victims to liability. And he says all kinds of things in an interview transcript that's in those documents about how these were the concerns that led him to cut this deal. Make of that what you will.
I'd make of one thing. Aren't they the people that would be doing the prosecution?
That's the thing, that he was eventually convicted under state law. And the picture Acosta paints, which I suppose can't be, he was under oath, so it can't be totally devoid of truth, was that Epstein's very high-priced lawyers, who included Alan Dershowitz and Ken Starr, who was the special prosecutor who went after Bill Clinton, and, you know, his investigation eventually disclosed his relationship with Monica Lewinsky, they were really staging this sort of all-out assault on the effort to prosecute Epstein. And Acosta claims that it was all that they could do to get him charged under these state laws, and that Epstein's defense team were being very uncompromising, and he was having to try to manage the possibility, which eventually transpired, that Epstein's lawyers would go over his head to Washington, D.C., to the higher-ups in the then Bush administration to get him off the hook. So this was in 2007, 2008. Anyway, at that time, he was imprisoned under state law in the Palm Beach County Jail, a private wing of the Palm Beach County Jail, which he paid for and basically was almost immediately on work release. So really was just sleeping there and spending the rest of the day on work release at a foundation that he also controlled and set up. So the lightest imaginable jail sentence. You hear about these Scandinavian jails and it makes them sound like Alcatraz or something. Anyway, he was apparently not rehabilitated though, as we now know. And what happened with the Edge Network was that he had been the principal funder of the Edge Network and its largest donor. And in some ways, this whole thing was geared to be a networking opportunity for him. And networking really is what he did above all, above anything else. And it seems from my reporting that not only did he resume attending these events and resume sponsoring these events and was actually coordinating with this Brockman guy while he was still serving his sentence, but Brockman and the organization appear to have taken some pains to conceal the fact of Epstein's ongoing participation in this network and his ongoing presence at events alongside these people who are now number among the wealthiest people in the world. And it appears also that the billionaires' dinner, this annual dinner, was usually timed to coincide as a side event, so to speak, of the annual TED conference, which during the period I reported on, it had been held in Long Beach, California for a really long time at a large conference venue there, and it moved to Vancouver. And I found pretty good evidence that he had attended these billionaires' dinners, certainly as late as 2014 and perhaps as late as 2016. There's also signs in what I found that Brockman and Epstein were very aware as time went on of his increasingly toxic reputation. There was a kind of a turning point where a number of his victims, including Virginia Giuffre, filed a lawsuit in New York in 2015, which brought the whole thing to the surface again, really created serious reputational difficulties for Epstein. And it was increasingly evident to both of them that this was beginning to be a problem for people who were concerned about their own reputation. And there were some people who were just clearly disgusted by this guy and what he'd done and had been reminded of it. And so it was increasingly difficult for him to attend some of the, I don't know, masterclass type events that they were having. But it seems like he was able to attend the dinners right until the end. The other thing that really struck me as I was going back over the public record in putting that story together, because some of this stuff is a long time ago now and our memories are somewhat foreshortened, it seems to me. There seems to be, I've seen some stories reported in the last few weeks that have already been reported at some point in the past. And it's not bad to be reminded of this stuff. But one thing that did strike me is that his initial conviction, a lot of people have been able to get away with saying that they just weren't aware of what he'd done or weren't aware of the severity of his offending or had some kind of false impression of the nature of that offending. I got to tell you, there were national and international stories about Epstein and what he had done and what he was accused of. Going back to kind of like 2006 in the New York Times, in British newspapers, and Prince Andrew's involvement came to light very early as well, as did Epstein's ties to Peter Mandelson. And there were a lot of, and definitely in Florida, the Miami Herald was publishing front page stories for like over a decade before Epstein died. And so it's really hard to take seriously the idea that any of the people who continued to associate with him weren't aware of what he'd been up to and what he was accused of. And clearly that just wasn't a problem for a lot of people.
And partly because they went to pains to obscure the fact that he was attending these events.
Right. And look, I found that it happened with one kind of network. But we've seen with Peter Mandelson, with what do we have to call him now? Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, with the former Prince Andrew, with all kinds of people, with Howard Lutnick, the Secretary of Commerce in the Trump administration, people just blatantly dissembling about the extent of their relationship with him. And being able to get away with that for a really long time and others dissembling on their behalf. I think I read a pretty good article on Navarra Media this morning, just pointing out the extent to which Britain's political media ran defense effectively for Peter Mandelson for such a long time. Because yes, these new documents really mean it's unavoidable. You just simply have to acknowledge that he and Jeffrey Epstein were very good friends, that it appears that Epstein paid Mandelson large sums of money, that Mandelson was leaking valuable information to Epstein. And of course, that's allegations that the police are currently investigating, it reportedly. There are some emails where it reads like if it may be that Epstein is procuring people for him to have sex with. It seems that way. Some of the emails read that way. That's what they may be saying. I don't know if you saw it this morning, but a UN panel this morning late yesterday, a UN panel of experts have said that Epstein's network may constitute a global criminal enterprise that carried out acts meeting the legal threshold of crimes against humanity. And that doesn't mean that everyone in Epstein's network was engaged in crimes against humanity, right? But people in positions of high responsibility, whether in business or in government, it's very difficult for them to claim that they simply weren't aware of what this guy was up to. And it's evident that a lot of them, even if they weren't colluding and collaborating in this gigantic sex trafficking network, they should have been aware of it. And some of them clearly were aware and just didn't care because of the advantages that his network conferred to them. It's really quite extraordinary. And I know that it's a saturation media topic at the moment, but it's this story of elite corruption has caught on in a way that earlier things like the Panama Papers really didn't. The Panama Papers was a story that, you know, the records of corporate registrars in Panama and other tax havens were leaked, and they disclosed the fact that members of an overlapping global elite had gigantic sums of money offshore in order to avoid tax and in order to transact in ways that weren't transparent, and whether in order to hide money or to hide business enterprises. And like that did get reported out and it was a big story, but it faded away. This story of corruption seems to be sticking around, and it may well yet still bring down Keir Starmer, if not his government. It may end up with a former prince of the realm in the United Kingdom on trial. It has torn through the Norwegian royal family. It's causing, like it caused that sultan in the UAE to be dismissed from a massive infrastructure corporation in Dubai, and he's one of the architects of Dubai. It doesn't yet seem to be having much of an effect in the United States, or not a visible effect, but I think that it's very obvious that Donald Trump had a very close relationship with Jeffrey Epstein for a very long time. He has resisted being transparent about that relationship, and he resisted the release of these kind of documents. Some members of his cabinet, like Howard Lutnick, are very much implicated here. It doesn't seem to be having any immediate political effect in the United States, but I don't think it's done very much for the authority and standing of Donald Trump.
Jason, people like you and me, I don't know what you want to call us, woke scolds, the fact-checking class, that sort of person, have been banging on for half a decade now that the concept of this elite cabal of pedophiles, as laid out in the QAnon conspiracy theory, for example, is an absurdity. And then we discover that not only is there an elite cabal of pedophiles, which is not that absurd, but that conspiracy theory was started on websites that Jeffrey Epstein was talking to the owners of.
Yeah.
It seems quite a bit.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Look, mea culpa, there is a global cabal of elite pedophiles. I think it is interesting, isn't it, that he had contact with the founder of 4chan, right? And seems to have been somewhat proximate to the whole Gamergate thing. Definitely his very good buddy Steve Bannon was entirely proximate to that, to these conspiracy-minded narratives that they used to assemble a coalition, to create a cultural and political movement, to really, I guess, undermine liberal democratic institutions in the United States and beyond. I guess in our defense, in the defense of woke scolds everywhere, Cam, I would say that they built all that with only the most slender foundation of evidence, right? I just don't think there's a lot of evidence of a global pedophile cabal in Hillary Clinton's leaked emails or hacked emails, despite the allegations that there were. And that's not to say that the Clintons are not associates of Jeffrey Epstein's, that clearly they are. But I think a lot of that was really manufactured on the basis of not much. The evidence that we have here is undeniable. And look, the thing that they also mobilized people around the idea that the Epstein files should be released and that there would be all of this, all of these revelations in the Epstein files, principally about Democrats. Now, I guess if you were going to say, was Jeffrey Epstein a Democrat or a Republican? Probably, for the most part, like a Democrat. That's his associations, right, with the Democratic elite. Certainly as you go further back, he obviously became quite bonded with Steve Bannon later on. And I think ultimately he's right above politics, certainly above the cut and thrust of U.S. domestic politics. I think he's been a benefactor to people on both sides. But yeah, it is interesting, isn't it, in retrospect, that something resembling the truth was manufactured in order to benefit some of the people who are most closely connected to the criminal enterprise and the network that Jeffrey Epstein was running. It's quite bizarre, isn't it? I don't know what you make of that, what you guys make of that, but obviously people have leapt to this idea that the whole thing was a psyop or a smokescreen for what was really going on. I'm hesitant to be definitive about that on the basis of what we have already, but it is striking, isn't it?
It is. I think I am on the record as saying that the craziest thing that I believe is that the people who would most benefit from there being a conspiracy theory like this would be the people who were actually doing it. But I don't need to look into what I said exactly.
Yeah, and it's the reason I think that it's the same sort of reason that people are often suspicious of, say, Alex Jones or the more far out conspiracy theorists, which is that the QAnon or whatever discredits the very idea that there could be such a thing. Right? This is just so crazy that anyone who talks about, you know, what are in other contexts are called parapolitics, right? The idea that there's this dense interpenetration of organized crime and high finance and government, right? It discredits anyone who uses that kind of framework to think about the world. And maybe that's what the woke scolds fell victim to, like precisely that strategy, right? Where you put out a version of the truth that's just so far out and obviously insane that people are just repelled by it and think that it can't possibly be true. And look, it is still hard to believe. It's hard to believe that people were allowed to operate like this in the world with no consequences for decades. It is hard to believe. It is staggering in its implications. And one of the big questions I have is that were it not that wealth and wealth inequality became so dramatic in the last three or four decades, if wealth inequality was not so dramatic, if the wealthiest people in the world did not have such staggering multiples of the resources of the poorest people, but even the median people in the world, would this have been able to take place? Would they have been able to ride roughshod over the law? Would they have been able to pay for the army of lawyers that they needed to in order to evade consequences or even scrutiny? Would it be that all of their pals were in control of strategic, whether like legal institutions or media institutions that might have held them to account? That's got to be one factor, right? And also, I think I got to say, I don't know if you've been reading the stories on DropSite, but Epstein embodies, to some extent, the corruption that surrounds the US's relationship with several countries, including the UK, but also including Israel, right? It seems to me like this effort to portray him as some Russian intelligence asset. Look, if he's a Russian intelligence asset, that just means he's gone plural. He's engaged with multiple intelligence agencies. Certainly, he and Ehud Barak both tried really hard to get meetings with Vladimir Putin. But there's no evidence that they actually did get a meeting with Vladimir Putin, for one thing. There's lots and lots of evidence that Epstein was incredibly well connected to highly placed peoples in the governments of the United Kingdom and Israel and a couple of European countries to boot. So, Yeah, and he was something of an arms dealer as well. And the drop sites reporting suggests that maybe he had something to do with Iran-Contra. Like, it's nuts. It's beyond anything. It's too sophisticated of a structure and a tale for someone like Alex Jones to dream up. It's just too... And I think we're going to be unraveling those complications for a really long time if the shortened attention span of the media and its consumers doesn't move on. But I have this feeling with this one, people are going to want to know more about it for quite a while.
You are listening to Yeah Nah Passaran on 3CR, 8:55 a.m., 3CR Digital on your DAB radio or 3cr.org.au on the World Wide Web. We are currently talking to Jason Wilson about Jeffrey Epstein. If you want to keep radio like this going, you can go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe and sign up to help the station. All right, here is Jason.
Jason, I also wonder what you make of the other people who were drawn to Epstein's circles, including one relatively well-known and retired linguist.
Yeah.
Appears to have benefited from some small donation, but whose subsequent exposure of there being a more intimate or closer relationship than had previously been understood has taken some of the shine off this person.
Yeah, so we're talking about Noam Chomsky.
We're talking about Uncle Noam.
So I have actually thought about this one a little, and it's hard to think about it because I think he's someone who a lot of people on the left have had enormous respect for a really long time. And I just – and it's clear from the emails, it's embarrassing because he was a trophy for Epstein, right? So he was someone for Epstein to wheel out at dinners with the likes of Ehud Barak and others to put the case for Palestine, to put the best possible case for Palestine. And this was one kind of party that Epstein used to like to have. There's also emails I've read where Epstein's academic associates are mostly in the field of evolutionary psychology, which I'm not going to slander entire academic disciplines, but there is a lot of overlap between evolutionary psychology and a eugenicist point of view. There's a lot of people in that field who express those kinds of views. And it's clear that Epstein himself had something of a eugenicist point of view and, I don't know, wanted to seed the human race with his incredible genetic material and also had beliefs, I think, about the relative intelligence and capacity of Ashkenazi Jews in relation to other people. He certainly expresses that from time to time. And according to Steven Pinker, and this isn't necessarily in the emails, this is previous reporting, and I haven't actually found anything to directly contradict this, but Pinker was certainly an associate at one time, and he claims that he was, as he put it, voted off the island after he had an argument with Epstein, we'll say argument, where Epstein was saying that desperately poor people in other parts of the world should just be allowed to die because it was beyond our resources to feed them and everyone would be better off. And that subsidizing poor people just encourages them to have more kids. That was actually the nub of the discussion, right? Subsidizing poor people around the world, like foreign aid to these countries, just encourages people to have more kids and exacerbates the problem. And Pinker pointed out, I guess to his credit, that there's a lot of evidence actually that desperate poverty encourages people to have more kids and that if you can actually give people the resources they need, basically their birth rate's slow. Now, I'm giving him credit in the context of a conversation that's pretty cold-blooded and maybe eugenicist on its own terms, but that's what he claims the final disagreement that got him kicked out of the circle was. Anyway, there's an email I read where one of these guys, I forget the guy's name, but he's basically pushing back on Chomsky's arguments against the idea of IQ, intelligence or IQ as they always want to discuss it, being a strict matter of heredity, right? As opposed to something that develops environmentally and can be influenced by nutrition and life circumstances, social factors. And so it seems like Chomsky was that kind of figure in this circle. He was the kind of in-house left-wing contrarian. And it seems that was the reason that Epstein wanted to have him around, as this left-wing contrarian in his little salon, with which he would test out the arguments of the other people who are on average pro-Israel, pro-eugenics, pro a whole bunch of right-wing things, I guess, right-wing ideas. And I don't know why Chomsky assented to being that guy. I just can't imagine why. The most charity, and this is extending charity possibly further than it should go, the most charitable explanation I can come up with for him not just recoiling from this guy is that Chomsky just assumes that the media just kind of lie about everything, and that whatever Epstein had done had been massively exaggerated by the media for some reason. I don't know. For some reason.
Well, to manufacture some consent, I imagine.
Yeah, but consent for what?
For something, I'm sure.
And so that's the best I could come up with, because it's really hard to... Yes, he did. It seems like he got some sum of money. I forget what the exact figure was, Andy. I don't know if you remember. It did seem like a lot of money, though, right?
It didn't seem like a lot. I think at most perhaps $20,000 for some academic project.
And Chomsky for sure can access sums of that magnitude just through academic grants or whatever. And it's not even clear what he would need that for, that sum of research money for. I don't know. I don't know what. But it's really hard for me to understand, actually. I've thought about it and it's hard for me to understand. Do you have any ideas?
I guess one thing that's interesting perhaps about Epstein himself was the way in which he wanted to collect these characters. And I wonder to what extent, like Jason, you were making reference to Alex Jones before, and I happened to notice that someone from InfoWars will be in Australia, I think, this weekend for a conference organised by Advance, along with our former Prime Minister Tony Abbott and various other luminaries. I guess in terms of the kinds of ideas that are being seized upon as being worthwhile as a way of manufacturing some kind of consent, or at least is there any sense you've got from reading through this material that there's some particular elite consensus that's emerging among the ranks of these billionaires and technocrats, Jason?
I think I've mentioned a couple of things that are quite striking. I think a eugenic worldview is quite pervasive, right? And a sense that place of this elite, you know, like their position is somehow a natural outcome of their superiority to ordinary people. They think that they go looking for evidence that intelligence, for example, is an inborn quality, and that people in their positions just happen to be more intelligent than other people are. That's just one aspect of it, though. I think that there is, certainly where Epstein's concerned, there is an implicit, occasionally explicit sort of white supremacy there. And also, it has to be said, a notion of the supremacy of his own ethnic group. I would say that there is a consensus. There's definitely a consensus in favor of these guys really believe that like Davos, the World Economic Forum. There's a conversation that Epstein has where he speculates about Davos replacing the UN. And look, we may or may not have our criticisms of the United Nations, but the United Nations is a gathering of the duly appointed representatives of sovereign governments, and that's not what Davos is. Davos is a self-selecting elite, a transnational elite, really. I think that's something that these people, they're not nationalists in any simple way, except maybe when it comes to Israel and its claims. But there's this sense that the West, there's this custodial transnational elite that is not only in charge in Europe and North America, let's say, and has opportunities beyond Europe and North America, say in West Africa. Epstein was very interested in opportunities there. And also he had this obviously colonial view of Eastern Europe as well. That's where a lot of the people, and South America, which is where a lot of the recruiting for his sex trafficking organization went on. And he and the people he spoke to clearly saw that there was money to be made in these emerging markets, let's say. But his friends, his peers, the people he saw as his peers, the people he was trying to build networks with, you know, are either like hereditary monarchs and aristocrats, right? Or this elite that has emerged at the top of the world of banking, of business, and of the arms trade and politics, right? Like the QAnon people might be wrong about it having been exclusively Democrats and they were going to finally pin down Bill Clinton. But it is quite uncomfortable, perhaps, for some to consider the fact that, leaving aside the monarchs, right, the politicians he was dealing with were like the neoliberal center-left for the most part, right? Ehud Barak, like Peter Mandelson, like Bill Clinton. And so there's like there's an odd kind of progressivism in there as well, but it's very much the one that we used to hear in that era of globalization and the third way, this sort of idea that markets would flatten the world out and that at the same time would present opportunities to people like Jeffrey Epstein and his network. That's a whole bunch of stuff, and it's not necessarily – my presentation of it is not necessarily coherent, but I think that's about right. There's this supreme self-confidence in this self-selected elite that he assembled into this network, which was, yeah, forward-looking. It's the global power elite of the Windows 7 era. You know what I mean? And I think that's a good stab at the flavor. It's this sort of tech triumphalism, market triumphalism, the triumphalism of the unipolar moment geopolitically, of the hollowing out, really, of social democratic parties by the end of the Cold War, their capitulation to free market ideology, of the unchallenged power of the Atlanticist alliance and the subservience and the view of everything outside that Atlanticist alliance as a resource to be exploited and incorporated into that market. And that's, he's not a philosopher. He can barely write. These are all what I would say are the kind of assumptions that you can see underpinning, you know, everything he says and does and the people he talks to say and do. I think it's interesting that when it comes to Israel, his closest friend is Ehud Barak, and he doesn't seem to be very much connected to Likud or Netanyahu or the Israeli. And he and Barak both seem to share a certain antipathy to them. And I'm pretty sure there's an email in there where he's explicitly acknowledging that at least one or two emails where he's explicitly acknowledging his support for the two-state solution, which was just really the foreign policy, the Atlanticist foreign policy consensus of that time. Like it's, I don't think it was a deep commitment or anything. But it's important to remember that at that time, that was still like a viable governing ideology in Israel, and it no longer is. So yeah, it's like that moment, which in so many ways has just fallen apart, to some extent courtesy of Donald Trump. And the interesting thing, I think, I read a really good piece by Melinda Cooper, where she was saying that this is Epstein's ideology is the ideology of the global far right, and in that they want to, with her kind of lens with household economies and stuff, they want to reduce everyone to the sort of status of a household servant. And that's who Epstein surrounds himself with. And I think I see her point, and I don't even disagree. But I think there's a more uncomfortable sense that I have that really most of this material comes from a little way back, from aughts and the teens. And I think what it really embodies, the network and the discussions in it, and Epstein himself, is a consensus of the unipolar neoliberal center, really. Yes, he explicitly ran a horrible, monstrous sex trafficking ring. But like Europe and North America, it's a more explicit and monstrous version of the kind of colonialism that was happening at that time under the guise of globalization and neoliberalism. I don't know. And that's been brought undone, including by people like Donald Trump, by right-wing populism. And the fact that Trump was a friend of Epstein shows how short the leap actually is in practice from that moment to right-wing populism. But it is interesting that a lot of the later conversations we have access to are conversations between Epstein and Steve Bannon. And both of them clearly regard Trump as a clown. And I think Epstein always thought Trump was a bit of a clown. He wasn't really, by the time and who knows what's been held back with respect to Trump specifically. But I would say that the sense I get from the materials we have available is that Bannon and Epstein were equally perplexed in a way and bemused by Trump's political success, and both of them thought he was a bit of an idiot, and but were both afraid of him and what he might be able to do to them now that he has power. But yeah, Trump's success took Jeffrey Epstein by surprise as well. And Trump also got away from Steve Bannon, who's a more ideological right-wing populist than Trump. And so that's interesting too. But yeah, I think that he's just a raw and concentrated version of the world that kind of led us to Donald Trump. I think that's what he believes. I don't think he had many interesting thoughts. He just operated in a world where a whole lot of assumptions, he took a whole lot of things for granted about the way that the world operated, let's say around 2010.
Jason, I think we're going to have to leave it there on, again, a very cheery note. If people want to find more of your work, you are on The Guardian.
Yeah.
People can find you on Blue Sky, jasonaw.bsky.social.
Yep.
Andy, it is Subscriber Month here at 3CR. If people want to subscribe, they can go to 3cr.org.au/subscribe.
Yes, please do. Help us stay on the air along with many other great programs.
And we will be back next week. See you then.
Bye-bye.
Keffiyehs are Palestinian scarves, and they're a symbol of support for justice for the Palestinian people. From the traditional black and white keffiyeh to an array of modern designs, explore the range and order online or drop by 3CR during business hours. Wear your support for the rights of Palestinians. Go to keffiyehs.org.au. That's KUFIYAS.org.au. A 3CR supporter.